Sessions in Depth Psychology is powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute. Your host is Bonnie Bright.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Discussions in Depth Psychology, which is powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute. I'm Bonnie Bright, and I received my PhD from Pacifica in the Depth Psychology program there, and I'm committed to giving back by helping to extend Depth Psychology in the world, particularly through this interview series where you can meet and learn from amazing individuals who are contributing so much to this important field. And as many of you will know, Pacifica's mission essentially translates to tending the soul of and in the world. And so each of the individuals that I interview is doing that in his or her own unique way. So today I'm really pleased to be speaking with Lance S. Owens, who is a historian, a physician, and by those who know his work, also an expert on C.G. Jung, and especially from a Gnostic perspective. And lately, Lance has been interested in the life and work of Eric Neumann, who was a close friend of Jung's, and who has made his own powerful contributions to the field of depth psychology through works like The Great Mother, The Origins and History of Consciousness, and Depth Psychology and a New Ethic, among others. So Lance, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you here, and I know you are just a wealth of knowledge about so many different topics. It's going to be hard for us to narrow it down, I think, but we will do our best to cover as much as we can. Before we go on, for everybody's benefit, I'm going to read Lance's biography in just a moment so that you know a little bit more about his background. But first, I should tell you that Lance is going to be speaking at an upcoming symposium at Pacifica Graduate Institute in Santa Barbara. That takes place June 24th through June 26th of 2016, and it's called Creative Minds in Dialogue, the Relationship Between C.G. Jung and Eric Neumann. And many of you will know or have heard that the correspondence between Jung and Neumann was published in 2015, and so it's received a lot of attention, and so we'll talk more about that and what that means. And at that symposium, Lance joined several other internationally acclaimed speakers, including Murray Stein, Lionel Corbett, Nancy Ferlotti, Anne Lammers, Rena Porat, Susan Rowland, Evan Lansing Smith, Steve Zemelman, and also Ricardo Bernardini of Aranos, and of course Ariel Shalit, who's a Jungian analyst based in Israel and who himself hosted a conference on the Jung-Neumann letters last year in 2015. So I don't know if anyone who is listening to this was lucky enough to attend that. I know that you were, Lance, but anyway, you may be familiar with a bunch of those presenters, and so hopefully if you have an interest in that conference, you can find information about that at pacifica.edu. So Lance, let me read your bio and then we'll jump right in. Lance S. Owens is an historian and a physician in clinical practice. He has served on the clinical staff of the University of Utah for over two decades, and since the publication of Jung's red book, Liber Novus, in 2009, Dr. Owens has published several studies focused on Jung's extraordinary visionary experience. His lectures and seminars on Jung and the Red Book, which are available online, have been enjoyed by many thousands of listeners. Dr. Owens is also a founder and editor of the Gnosis Archive, which is the major internet repository of ancient Gnostic texts, and including the complete Nag Hammadi Library of Gnostic Scriptures. And a catalog of his publications and audio lectures is available at www.gnosis.org/Lance-Owens. And if you have a hard time remembering that or didn't have a chance to write that down, pretty much if you Google Lance S. Owens and Jung or Gnosis, you will find all of his works. In fact, Lance, your work has been really inspirational to me over the past many years. You've made it so readily available. There's a lot of PDFs and articles there that are available for free, as well as some other things. So really appreciate the work that you have contributed to this amazing field of depth psychology in the past years.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Bonnie. You know, this this subject of Jung and Neumann has really been important to me. I, like many Jungians of my generation, I'm 65 now, I started diving into the depths of Jung 30 years ago. And, you know, at the beginning of that, Neumann was part of the canon of things one read. You know, his book, The Great Mother, and The Origin and History of Consciousness were part of the Jungian canon. But quite honestly, I read them and moved on. As the years went by, I always found that I was much more interested in Jung himself than in what other people had to say about Jung. It's like you really couldn't decide whether other people had a proper approach or understanding of the man without meeting the man himself. And as the years went by, I read less and less of the ancillary or secondary literature in Jungian studies, and my concentration really became one of meeting Carl Gustav Jung, who was this guy? Mm. Who was this very strange and interesting man? And so I've spent most of my career study really looking at Jung, understanding Jung. And through Nancy Frilotti's work and Dr. Earl Shalit's work, I became aware of Neumann and the years, decade of effort they put in trying to get Neumann's letters published, as they recently were last year. And they excited in me again an interest in who was this guy? Not just the books, but who was this man? And I'll tell you, he was an extraordinary man, and he's worth getting to know. Jung said lots of stuff, and people wrote these things down, and heaven knows if they got the quotes exactly right when they wrote them down in their journal. But at a point in his life, and I suspect it was probably in the late 1940s, Jung said that he only had two friends that he could talk to about his own problems. And those friends were Father Victor White and Erich Neumann. That's quite a statement. And when he said talk about my problems, he wasn't talking about his domestic problems or his medical problems. He was talking about the issues of soul that were critical to him. And the letters with Father Victor White and Jung were edited by Ann Lammers, who's going to be at our conference at Pacifica in June. They offer amazing insights into the problem, into the issues Jung was dealing with in that critical phase of his life. And now with the publication of the Neumann letters, we have another piece of that story, that piece of these two friendships, these two men who were communicating with Jung about his problems, the things that were most important to him. And I think Neumann, in many ways, understood Jung much better than did Father Victor White.
You bring up so many interesting points here, but a couple of them that I'll just pick up on. One is you have basically acknowledged, I think, what a lot of us who have studied Jung specifically felt, and that is he has so much charisma. And there's a certain fascination, I think, for those of us who are interested in Jung's work, which also parlays to the man himself. And, of course, we know quite a bit about his life because of the works that have been published and because it has been made accessible to us. But it's true that we don't necessarily always think, for those of us who are academics or in the more scholarly field, we don't always think about the person behind the writings. And that certainly has been the case for me, I think. So it's kind of interesting that you point out that your attention has really been drawn to Neumann as the man. And the other thing that occurs to me, and I want to hear a little bit more about that, so I'm hoping that we can next launch into a little bit of his story and his background for those who are not as familiar with even who he is in general, let alone some more of the details. But the other thing that I wanted to point out before we do that is that what Jung said about Neumann being one of his two friends who really seemed to understand him, I believe that I read that he made that statement just a few months before his death. And, of course, Neumann died in 1960. And I believe had recently passed at the time that he made that statement. And so for all the people that were vying for Jung's attention, I can only imagine over all those many years for him to come out and say that at a time, you know, when Jung was probably just months away from his own death, I think is symbolic of the deep connection that the two men had. So let's jump into that a little bit. Can you just share what you understand about Neumann's background a little bit, and how did Jung and Neumann come into a relationship? What was the relationship like between the two of them?
Well, let me just start with a general background, that in Jung's studies, there's been a lot of controversy about his relationship to Judaism, and it goes deep. It's a long story. But Neumann was a Jew. He identified himself with his Jewish tradition. And he came to Jung as a man leaving his exile. This is something really critical to understand about Neumann. Neumann was raised mainly in Berlin, in Germany. He was a German Jew. He came from an assimilated German family, not a religious family. At a point in his life, in his 20s, he really understood that there was no place for him in German culture. He was not a German. He was not a Christian. Neumann embraced the fact that he was a Jew, and that there was something special in that ancient tradition, that was part of him, that was part of his root. In 1933, after Hitler took over in Germany, Neumann knew that he would leave, and he left to go to Palestine, to Zion. On his journey, the first place he went was to Zurich to spend 6 months in analysis with Dr. Jung. He had met Jung earlier at the seminar that Jung had given in Berlin. He had heard him. He knew Gerhard Adler, another one of his dear friends who also knew Jung, and he went to Jung. As perhaps the initiatory phase of his movement to Palestine, to Israel. And Neumann came to Jung, now this is a sort of a technical question or a difficult issue, but it goes back to this charisma that you mentioned of Jung. Neumann went looking not just for analysis. Neumann went actually looking for a Tzaddik, I think, and in my opinion. He was looking for a guide. Now, Neumann was a very sensitive man. He had, in his own search for his Jewish heritage, been deeply influenced by Martin Buber's writings on Hasidism. And one of the key elements of Hasidism was Buber saw it as a real renewal in the Jewish spirit, something that happened in the 18th century. It was centered around some extraordinary men, the Baal Shem Tov, Rabbi Israel ben Eliezer, and Magid, his follower, his subsequent leader in the Hasidic movement. And these were people that Neumann saw recognized as having found a transparency in the world, a transparency between the outer and deeper or transcendent realities. They saw the divine in this place. And these men, through their vision, through their ability to see through the world, in the world, and bring that vision into their societies, had transformed their societies, had transformed their place. And that was, as Martin Buber certainly believed, and as Neumann also, I think, accepted and affirmed, a transformation in the Jewish spirit. There were important things happening. So when Neumann went and met Jung, he really met him as a Tzaddik, as one of these unique people that had an ability to see through this world, to see the depth in it. And Neumann affirmed repeatedly throughout the rest of his life that his encounter with Jung was the transformative event, that he could not imagine his life without that. That's not to say that the men did not have their disagreements. They did, and there were problems in their relationship. But Neumann went to Jung, and after 6 months with Jung, he went to Israel, and he established analytical psychology or complex psychology or depth psychology or Jungian psychology, however you want to call it. All those names have been used in Israel. And you've got to remember that nowadays we have these long training programs to become an analyst. At that time, there was one criteria Jung had for saying a person was ready to be an analyst. And that criteria was they knew the psyche was real. In analysis with Jung, that is the issue that one encountered, the reality, the psychic reality. And Neumann most certainly got it. And so Neumann went on to Israel, and he did establish depth psychology in Israel. But look, you know, when he went there, I mean, this was something new, and he was new to it. He went to Israel in 34, he arrived in 34, and he returned back to Switzerland a couple of times to talk with Jung, but then by 39, of course, the world was falling apart, the war had begun, and Jung and Neumann were cut off from communication, really, from 39 until after the war in 45, after the tragedy. During all those years, Neumann was seeing patients in Israel. He was seeing up to 50 hours a week. I mean, his patients didn't have much money. He had to make a living. He was seeing lots of people, and you can imagine the people he was dealing with, what they had been through in their escape from the impending and actual Holocaust. And then after the war, of course, the many people who had survived it. Those were his patients, the people he was dealing with. I mean, this was a man of great insight, and you can just imagine the sorts of issues he, as a psychologist, as a depth psychologist, was dealing with, issues of the Jewish spirit, of the Jewish experience. Right. So after the war, Neumann and Jung reestablished their communication. And Neumann, during the war, those years, he was in isolation. The letters is subtitled Analytic Psychology in Exile. Neumann was in exile. Many of Jung's disciples were right there with him through all of those years. They were always at his shoulder, sort of at the feet of the master. Neumann took what master had given him, and he went and he worked his own work. I mean, he dealt with his own dreams, his own imaginings, his own depths. And during all those years, he wrote. And when he came back to Zurich in 46, 47, those years after the war, he came back with a massive amount of things he had written, including the beginning of the book called Depth Psychology and the New Ethic, and then The Origin and History of Consciousness. Those were things he had really been working on. And you have to also understand that the other thing I didn't mention is that when Neumann went to Jung at 33, he was 29 years old. Jung was 30 years his senior. And so really in his 30s, up through 40, he was just an extremely creative individual, writing this stuff, dealing with what Jung had given him to start with, that entry into the fact that the psyche was real. Norman went there and he talked about it. But he talked about it, and this is really, I think, important to understand, he talked about it from his perspective. Jung, if you see him as a Tzaddik, a holy one or whatever, I mean, an insightful one, intuitive one, whatever, Jung had his problem, and his problems really began, the issues that were the problems of his life really began in the Red Book phase, and in the writing of Liber Novus, beginning in the fall of 1913 on through the period of the Great War up through 1918, 1919. And the issues Jung was dealing with were, well, Jung had seen that the Christian age was coming to an end. This is a declaration he makes on the first page, I think, of the Red Book. I've written about that in a paper called Jung and Ion. He saw that there was a transformation taking place, aeonial, a 2,000-year transformation taking place in human consciousness, that new God images were forming, that we had to come into a new relationship with the depths, with the psychic realm, that there were things bubbling up in us, through us, in our cultures, that were transformative in this age. It was really a change. And Jung, throughout his life, fully engaged those issues. Some of them stayed silent. Some of them stayed in the background. Some of them he felt he did not have, as he said, courage to speak. And he said clearly, I did not think I could speak my secret knowledge. In 44, Jung had this tremendous vision, these series of visions when he almost died in 1944 after a pulmonary embolism and heart attack. And that really transformed him. It was during that second period of communication that he really developed this dialogue with Victor White and then, importantly, with Norman, as Norman came back after his own considerations throughout the years of the war.
Yeah, this was so fascinating to look at the parallel sort of, what's really grabbing me is the parallel development of analytical or depth psychology during the time that Norman was in Israel. You know, that saying, necessity is the mother of invention, that's clearly where that comes from, because all that Norman had to work with was his somewhat limited exposure to Jung and Jung's works and Jung's ideas. And so being able to take that back to Israel and use it as a foundation for his work with a group of people that were clearly so traumatized by the events of the world going on at that time must have really allowed him to dig very deeply into all of the ideas that he had learned from both Jung and Buber, as you pointed out. This whole idea of the transparency between the realms and being able to see through to the divine, I'm sure was coming up on a regular basis. So it kind of makes me wonder, and I don't know if you know something about that, but it makes me wonder how much of what Norman was able to actually bring back from Israel when they reestablished communications around 1946. How much of that was new to Jung, do you think, or was a surprise to Jung, or inspired, or even sort of brought some kind of enlightenment to what Jung was working on at the time in his later works?
I think Jung's conclusion was that Neumann got it. He got it on his own. He got it in his own genuine experience. You know, the issues that Norman brought back, the first issue was Depth Psychology and the New Ethic. It's an incredible book. And Norman looked at this fact of the shadow seen in the other, the shadow in ourselves that we must encounter, an ethic based not upon the outer laws, but the inner realization of evil, evil even in our own selves and our relationship to it, our relationship to the truth within ourselves as a guide. I mean, this is stuff that Jung had been working on for years. It's stuff that he encountered in the Red Book period. And here Norman comes back, and when Norman gave Jung Depth Psychology and the New Ethic, you know, he praised it highly in private. But I should add that when Norman came back to Zurich, he was an outsider, and many of the people around Jung in Zurich did not quickly warm to Norman. Norman was a sensitive man. He was an introvert, and he was not one of the group. And so Norman was confronted with some antagonism, jealousy, one would say, from the group in Zurich. But Jung really affirmed his work. And then the second book that he came up with, and this was really 1949-1950, The Origin and History of Consciousness, Jung wrote back to him that it was brilliant. he said it was a continuation of exactly what he had been trying to do in his first major book, which is now published as Symbols of Transformation. In German, the original title is Wandlungen in Symbole der Libido, published in 1911, 1912. It was the book that broke his relationship with Freud. But in Origin and History of Consciousness, which I should add, Neumann wrote at about the same age that Jung had been when he wrote Symbols of Transformation, the first volume of it, that he saw Neumann was really engaging in just the sort of stuff he had looked at the evolution of consciousness in human history. Jung gave praise in portions to many people, but there's really no one's work I am aware of that Jung praised as directly and completely as he did the work of Erich Neumann, particularly those two books. And then Amor and Psyche, another book I think most Jungians have come across, Amor and Psyche, the psychic development of the feminine. Again, when Jung got his copy of it, in, I think in 1951, he again wrote back to Neumann, this is brilliant. This is a great book.
Right. One thing that I am curious about is, I think that Jung's work, you know, he had his faults, of course, but one thing that I really appreciate about Jung's work is that it seems like the more that I read, the more that I find ways that it applies universally, even today. I mean, you know, what he wrote half a century ago or 75 years ago still seems to have so much to do with our current circumstances. And of course, I was looking back through some of these books by Neumann in preparation for this conversation with you, Lance. And I noticed that the very first paragraph in Depth Psychology and a New Ethic starts like this, and I'm going to quote this. He says, "The problem of evil is one of the most central problems of modern man. No appeal to old values and ideals can shield us from the recognition that we live in a world in which evil in man is emerging from the depths on a gigantic scale and confronting us all, without exception, with the question, how are we to deal with this evil?" I mean, this is an age-old dilemma. I mean, it's archetypal at its very core. It's clearly still as relevant today, particularly when you look at what's going on in the world around us, as it was in 1949 when he wrote that. And I think it's obvious kind of why Neumann chose to focus on it in this book. I assume that a lot of it had to do with the Holocaust and what was going on in Nazi Germany at the time. But I'm wondering what you think about that and how you see that that connection is made to today. And that could be in terms of the shadow, but maybe also collective projection and the idea of the scapegoat.
You know, when I said that Jung felt that we were on the threshold of a great transformation of consciousness, I would add to that that Neumann got that too. I mean, he saw that as well. Jung was speaking about some of these transformations from his own heritage, from his dead. I mean, Jung felt a deep relationship to his tradition, his dead, his Christian history. And he was talking at it from his perspective. Neumann was coming to it from his perspective as a Jew with his tradition. But they saw the same things. If you look in the Red Book, and I know that there's still a lot of Jungians out there that haven't got the Red Book, haven't figured it out, haven't read it, haven't really probed this, but this is the core. This was the center of everything that followed afterwards with Jung. And in the Red Book, Jung encountered the fact that there was something forgotten in Christian theology, and it was evil. It was the Dark One. It was the mercurial figure. It was the shadow, the other. That this had to be incorporated into our coming conscious understanding of what it was to be human, that this evil exists. And the second issue was the forgotten feminine, the Sophianic, the indwelling immanence of a transcendence in this world that guides, like his soul had guided him. I mean, it's ambivalent at times, this inner world, this psychic realm. But that was important. Neumann caught these two themes. And, of course, you know, in Judaism, there's this thing called the Yetzer Hara, the inclination to evil. God is not, or at least the world that we live in, God's world, is not free of evil. In Jewish theology, all the way back, this concept of the Yetzer Hara, this inclination to evil, as being present in this world, is taken and understood. That was the great conflict Jung had with, you know, Father Victor White, who simply could not accept the fact that evil was real. In Catholic theology, evil was a privatio boni, simply an absence of the good. But, you know, Neumann had no problem understanding Jung on this one. They agreed. And then the second issue that had come really to Jung in the Red Book was the importance of the feminine, the forgotten feminine, the rejected feminine. And that's an issue that was central to Neumann. And Neumann, in his own encounter with Jewish tradition, with his tradition, saw its patriarchy, its centering on the masculine, its subjugation and forgetting of the feminine. And so that is really where Neumann focused his work. First, yes, in Depth Psychology and the New Ethic, on the nature and reality of evil, and second, on the forgotten or demonized quality of the feminine. And he did this in The Great Mother and then in many works thereafter. Neumann took from Jewish psychology the image of the Shekinah, or Shekinah, as some people sometimes say it. The Shekinah was actually the part of the transcendent, the feminine element of the transcendent, which was present in this world, exiled in this world. And our task was to find her, to meet her, bring her back into conjunction with the supernal, with the masculine. Jung saw very much the same thing in his own Red Book period, in his own psychology. And in that concept of the reality of evil and the need to rescue the feminine, Neumann and Jung were on the same page. And it wasn't something new to Jung. I mean, these are things he had been dealing with since 1913, 1914, 1915 in his visions that became the Red Book. And Neumann got it. I mean, Neumann, of course, probably did see parts of the Red Book when he was in analysis in 1930. At that time, Jung still had the thing on his desk. In their talks, undoubtedly, Jung told him about some of his own experiences. So, but you say, you know, relevance. Like, gosh, these guys wrote these things 50 or 60 years ago. It's relevant today? Well, you know, some things are just true. Some things are just real.
Right, yeah.
In this image of a transformation of consciousness, Jung was not talking about things that transformations of a 10 or 20 year period. He was looking at hundreds of years of a coming human consciousness of what would be developing. And his image of this new divine image and a new ethic that would follow upon it, it really involved, well, the recognition of the feminine, the recognition of evil, the recognition of a conjunctio in consciousness, a conjunctio between inner and outer, between sense and nonsense, between bright and dark, between masculine and feminine elements, however you gender them psychologically, apart from how you gender them physically. Those issues of conjunction, of recognition, were really critical to Jung, and they were critical throughout his life. But in many ways, he didn't start talking about it fully until after his illness in 1944. As he told Neumann in one of the letters, I took a great illness before I could talk about some of these things. So after that illness, we got the books called Ion, An Answer to Job, and Mysterium Conjunctionis. These were Jung's final statements, and they were really statements about things that he had seen in the Red Book period. And it was during this period that Neumann was his friend who he could talk about with his problems, these problems. Neumann got it. But he got it from his own perspective.
Right. It is so interesting, the parallels that we see there. And as you pointed out, it's not like Neumann hadn't heard of these topics and probably discussed many of these topics for his books in quite some depth with Jung. But you sort of see this parallel, except Neumann is kind of coming up with these books like 20 or 30 years after Jung really focused on it. It makes you wonder if Neumann, who died in 1960, he was born in early 1900s, I think. So he was quite young when he died. And
he was born in 1905. He died in cancer in 1961. I think he was 56 when he died. They were close.
Makes you wonder if he would not have also gotten to some of the other things that Jung got to eventually if he'd had a little bit more time to do that. But I have to say, his book, The Great Mother, I picked up a used copy of it in a bookstore, I think in New York some years ago, and I think it's the original 1955 version. It's quite old, but it's just a beautiful, beautiful book with the images and the research and the work that he did on the goddess images, and it's really beautiful. So if people who are hearing this haven't picked that up, they should definitely do that. But I wanted to go back as we sort of round this out, back to this whole idea that the contrast between the fact that Neumann was a Jew and that Jung was a Christian. And you had mentioned to me, kind of in passing.
Let me add to that, though.
Go ahead.
Jung was a heretical Christian, not a practitioner. And you might say Neumann was an heretical Jew, not a practitioner. But they respected bear root in their traditions. Let me put it that way. Yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. So again, yeah, thank you for that clarification. It's important because, again, you know, there's so much talk, I feel like, in deaf circles about taking religion literally versus looking at it from an archetypal or mythological standpoint. And obviously, these two great men who were so versed in their field were able to look at this archetypally or symbolically. It does say something very important about the practice of deaf psychology altogether. But I'm wondering if we have a general understanding that Jung found his myth. And this is something that you had mentioned to me in passing in an email not long ago. And I think we're mostly familiar with that story and the idea that Jung had found his own myth. But you were suggesting that to be a Jew may be different in seeking your own myth. And I'm wondering how you perceive that kind of process in Neumann's story. Where did he get his myth from? And was he ever actually able to really identify it and live into it?
Well, I would say whether you identify yourself as a Christian or a Jew or a Mormon or a Buddhist or a Hindu, people in all of these traditions have actually been interested and are now interested in Jung. So, you know, the thing is, when you find your myth, the issue is it's yours. It's what's in you. What's your story? And look, my authentic story is not going to be found in Buddhism. I mean, that's just not, it's not where I was raised, not in me. You know, I have great sympathy for Buddhism, and I've read a great deal and studied a great deal. It's given me perspective on things that are more naturally my own. But I know what's mine. I know the burdens. I know the questions that have come to me from my peoples, from my ancestors, both near and more distant. I have lots of friends who are dead. I have lots of dead friends who I never even met, but they're my friends, and Neumann is one of them. So is Jung. You know, it's finding what's authentically yours. And it involves actually going in to your history, your psychic history, your heritage, the heritage that comes to you in a dream, in a vision, that comes to you without really any cognitive, shall we say, planning of the process. You know, we think we're going to plan this process of individuation. Well, that isn't how it works. That isn't how it works. And so Neumann, you know, he came to his own myth authentically. And he had to relate to his tradition, what he felt was his own. And he did. And as he came to that tradition, and particularly through his study of Hasidism and Kabbalah, he found within Judaism a mystical root that was really important to him and that was genuinely part of his history. So, you know, and this is the other interesting thing, is that there's been a lot of talk about Jung's relationship to Judaism, but by the 1940s, Jung was coming to a deep understanding that many of the issues he had seen developing in the dynamic transformation he was anticipating in Christianity, those same issues had been met by the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidism. In fact, I think Jung said in 1953 or thereabouts that all of my psychology you can find in Israel Ben Eliezer, the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidism. Mm. That's a statement he would not have made if he hadn't have known Neumann, I assure you. Neumann helped him towards that.
Right. Mm.
But the issue is, he didn't come to it through Judaism. He came to it through his own tradition, through his own myth. Neumann authentically came to it in his own way. But the conjunctions were the same. The fact of the psyche and the archetypal structure, some of the core issues are human. Whatever our religious association, whatever our social issues, there are core issues that are simply human issues. Evil certainly is one of them. The issue of masculine and feminine polarities, Shiva, Shakti, light, dark, put it any way you want. And those are universals. We come to those universals in our own way, authentically.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And that to me is just such core, profound depth psychology. If we could all of us just focus and meditate on that one core tenet, the world would be such a different place. Lance, I'm so grateful for your time today. It's gone really fast, and it's just been so fascinating. I can only imagine what kind of content and amazing information that everyone who attends the conference is going to be able to get. Just a reminder for everybody, that conference is taking place in Santa Barbara at Pacifica Graduate Institute on Jung and Neumann, and it starts June 24th, 2016, so you can find out more information about that at pacifica.edu. And Lance, I just wanted to close out here by reading something that you wrote to me in an email that I just thought was so profound. You wrote, "Neumann has become one of those dead friends of the soul that come to help and haunt us with their questions and their answers and the facts of their own lives. I do now believe that hearing Neumann's voice across the decades is a crucial event in understanding the development of Jung's movement and of Jung's own experience. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And again, everyone, you can find out more about Lance S. Owens. If you just Google him, you'll find a lot of his writings and information online. Or you can go
to... Or come to the conference.
Go ahead.
We'll talk.
Absolutely. Yes. Again, you've been so generous with your time and your information, and I really look forward to meeting you in person. Thank you so much.
Okay. I'll look forward to it, Bonnie. Thank you so much for talking today.
You've been listening to Discussions in Depth Psychology, powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute with host Bonnie Bright.